Okay. I just wanted to mention that, you know, I always speak about the concept of that there's no such thing as reading the Torah. You really have to analyze the Torah. And I always like to show a source, a biblical source for the ideas of Torah. And there is a wonderful biblical source for that one. And it's in Nehemiah 8:8. Okay? It's an important verse there, so I'm just going to mention that briefly. It says, "And they read in the book of God's Torah, Meforesh means openly, and the next two words of in Hebrew is the Som Sechel, and that means to place intelligence, or we would say with the use of intelligence." Okay? And the next phrase is, "And they understood in depth in the reading of the verses of the Torah." Okay, so there you see that it gives you three. There are three constructs there on the study of Torah: the reading the open verses, the text, and then the using one's intellect, and then understanding the in-depth meaning of the text. So you see from the Bible itself, you have a source that there's no such thing as Bible reading. There's only Bible understanding. If you don't understand it, then you simply, if you don't use your intelligence, if it's not an intellectual activity, then you're nowhere near the idea of studying Torah. Another source I wanted to tell you was that I mentioned that all of perfection is can be summed up as how far removed a person is from idolatry. And there's a source for that as well. And that is in Genesis, where Jacob mentioned to his children, and that is in Genesis 35. And there's 35:2. It says, "Jacob said to his household and all that were with him, remove the strange gods that are in your midst, and cleanse yourself and change your clothes." Now, of course, it doesn't mean that heaven forbid to say that they worshiped the strange gods. What it meant was, it was a removal from any type of association with idolatry. And then he says, "We will go to Bethel, and I will make an altar to the God that answered, that answers me in the day of my, trial and tribulation." So the concept over there is that before we approach God, Jacob was saying, that we must remove ourselves even further from idolatry and remove ourselves from any type of association with idolatry, which meant throwing away the idols, even though those idols were not technically prohibited. Okay. Now let me get back to the topic at hand, and that is the brazen serpent. By the way, the brazen serpent I don't believe is accurate, because brazen is really brass. And it probably was not brass, because brass was something that that wasn't in existence, actually. I shouldn't say it wasn't in existence. It wasn't recognized at the time. Brass is an alloy of copper and zinc. What they had in those days was either plain brass or bronze. You know, the Bronze Age. That goes back quite a bit. But brass was actually introduced later. So it was either bronze or the word literally means copper. Okay, now let's get back to the serpent. Okay, so serpent. Now, I mentioned last week that there is a contradiction, I should have used the word perhaps discrepancy, between the two verses over here that we have over here in Numbers. And let's take a look at that more carefully. Yes, I realized after I said that in order to recognize the discrepancy, you really have to have a knowledge of Hebrew. All right. Now, tell you what the discrepancy is. The discrepancy is, it says in verse 8, and God said to Moses, make a venomous serpent and place it on a pole, and whoever is bitten will see it and live. Okay? The next verse says, and Moses made, and over here, by the way, there's another thing, another discrepancy, so to speak, between the two verses, and that is, it says, Moses made a copper, a snake made out of copper. God did not instruct him to make it out of copper. Okay? So this was his own, his own idea. And the rabbis say, because it is the word nachash in Hebrew, the word nachosh is for copper, and the word nachash, snake, both have the exact same root. Alright, so it's nachash, it's a snake of nachoshes, which is, the word nachoshes is copper. Okay. So it's the same, in other words, it's repetitious, it's a homonymous, in other words. You have a homonym here. You have two words that are homonymous, the same root, but they mean two different things. Okay? So what's the importance of that? We have to understand what the importance of that is. Let's keep that one question in mind, okay? But now let's get back to the other discrepancy that I mentioned last week. And that is, it says, and it will be if a serpent bites a person, then that person will look to the copper snake, and he will live. Now, in verse 8, the word to look is ra'ah in Hebrew, which means simply to see it. The word in verse 9, where it says to look, it uses a different word, and that word in Hebrew is hibit. Hibit means to stare at, or to gaze at. So there are two different words in Hebrew. One means to look at, which means it simply, it comes within the range of your vision, and it registers on your optical nerve, that's ra'ah. But then hibit means more than that. The word hibit means to stare at. So the question is, why the discrepancy? First it says that it will be anyone that is bitten will simply see the snake, and he will live. And the second time it says, no, he has to stare at the snake in order to live. Now that's a contradiction. Either you just have to see it, or else you have to gaze at it. Okay. So the commentaries explain that the first verse, if you look at it again, let's take a look at that verse 8 again. It says, and it will be whoever was bitten. So here it's speaking about the person that received the bite. And it doesn't say what the source of the bite is. So the rabbis say that it means anyone who was bitten from any source, a dog or a donkey or anything that bites, would die, all right? And then it says that all he had to do was to simply look at the snake, okay, and then he would live. Now in the second, in verse 9, it says if a serpent would bite a person, then they would have to gaze at the copper snake and live. So the rabbis explain this is not a discrepancy here, but this is intentional. Verse 8 is referring to anyone that was bitten by anything. Verse 9 is referring to someone who was bitten exclusively by a snake. And therefore, this is what the verse is telling us. That if the person was bitten by anything at all, they would die unless they looked at, in other words, just saw the copper snake. But if a person was bitten by a snake, then it wasn't enough just to look at it, but they had to actually gaze at it in order to be cured. Okay. I'm just going through the facts. So these are the facts we have. The first question we raised is that God did not tell Moses to make it out of copper. And Moses did. Why? Because he said the language is homonymous. It's like a double language, okay? So that's why he did it. Now, what is the significance of the fact that they both are the same sounding words, but they have two different meanings? So what is it? Who cares about that? Okay, that's the first question. The second question is, we want to understand the difference now being introduced, and a careful analysis of the text, that there's a difference between a person that was bitten by any animal at all, who would die also unless they simply saw the snake, and a person who actually had to gaze at it, and that is the person that was bitten by a serpent, by a snake.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I look back in the text of this, and after you asked us to look over this last week, and I did, if you look in verse 6, and it says, "And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people,
right,
and they bit the people, and many people of Israel died."
That's correct.
Therefore, in light of this, the people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord,
right,
and against thee, pray unto the Lord,
right,
and he take away the serpents from us." And Moses prayed for the people.
Right.
And the Lord said unto Moses, "Make a fiery serpent and set it upon a pole, and it shall come to pass that everyone that is bitten, when he looketh upon it, shall live." To me, it appears that the people that are spoken of in verse 8 are the same people that are mentioned in verse 6.
In verse 6, they died. You can't bring them back. That's it. Once they're dead, they're gone. In other words, in verse 6, it says that God sent in the nation.
It said many people, but it didn't say all the people that were bit, or much people, I believe,
well,
is in the text.
The plain interpretation is the ones that were bit died. It doesn't say everybody was bitten. It doesn't say that each person in the nation was bitten. Mm. But the ones that died, that's it. You can't bring them back. They're gone. Now the question is, the remaining ones came and said that, you know, they don't want that to happen to them. So then you had this whole new situation, this whole new remedy that was being introduced. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
He's going to talk. Yes? Any questions?
All right. This is the same thing we talked about. Somebody said, well, if you're looking on this is the same thing we talked about. This has got to be idolatry.
Oh, one thing. I'm not
Well, I know you're not through yet.
I didn't get to my answer yet.
I know that.
Gotta give me a chance there.
All right, we're waiting on you, but that's what you and I were talking about,
right,
the other day.
That, oh, yeah.
Without the proper interpretation of
that. Yes, oh, correct, yes.
That's what I'm saying. Okay.
Now, I want to make one thing clear, and that is that there is a difference between God meeting out justice to a human being and a miracle. Okay? What I mean is as follows. If a person is evil and the person dies as a result of God's judgment, so then this divine judgment is not considered a miracle. Okay? This is what we call providence, divine providence. That's not considered the miraculous. But when we have a change in the laws of nature, like the splitting of the sea and the water standing as a solid surface, like a pillar, like pillars on each side, that already is that's miraculous. Okay, that's a change in the law of nature. Again, when we have, even with the locusts, which was brought by the wind, but the Bible says that it never happened before or after. So therefore, that is a breach or a change in the law of nature. The quantity reflects something unusual, some kind of unusual event in the laws of nature. But when if a person should die because of a sin, I want to make that clear, that is not considered, according to the Torah, a miracle. That's simply an act of divine providence. Just like God rewards the righteous, he punishes those who are evil, and that's a constant, ongoing thing, and how he does that we don't know. But this is not considered in the eyes of Torah a miracle. It's simply considered part of divine providence. That concept is found throughout the Torah. In other words, if a person is righteous and God rewards him and he becomes wealthy and he has a successful life, whatever way God rewards him, that reward is not considered a miracle. It's considered part of God's divine providence. If a person is evil and they become ill and they die, that is not considered a miracle. That's, again, considered part of divine providence. Okay? Now, what we have to ask one question with regard to this chapter. And that is, what happened over here? Okay? Was the case that the poisonous serpent bit the person, and the person had poisonous venom in his system, which would result in his or her death, and then they looked up at the serpent, and they were cured? Is that what happened? Or no? Is what happened, the person was guilty of a sin, and therefore the person was, it was decreed by God's divine providence that the person should die. But it was also decreed by divine providence that the person should get bitten. In other words, there was a two things were decreed by God. One was that the person should become ill, and secondly, the person, the person or persons that were involved should be bitten. Okay? Now, then the person who looked at the serpent was saved not because, in other words, they were saved not from a poisonous venom that was physically in their body, but they were saved because it was decreed they should die because they were evil, and when they repented, then they were saved. Okay? Now, that you understand, if a person is ill, and a person repents, and God changes his decree, so to speak, which means that the person, like Hezekiah, when Hezekiah prayed to God, he was very ill, but then he had many years afterwards, the decree was changed, and he lived for many years after that. So this is not considered, again, this is not considered miraculous. Okay. Now, what I want to show is that a careful analysis of the Torah shows the second possibility, not the first. You see, where it mentions the venomous snakes, it only mentions that in the first incident, where it says that it states that the nation sinned, spoke against God and Moses, like we explained. It was an anthropomorphism of God. And then what happened was, it says God sent among the nation the venomous snakes, and they bit the people, and a large number died. Okay? Then, it says, God told Moses to make a serpent and place it on the pole. And then it says, and everyone that is bitten, and I explained that it means not the person who is, not a person who's bitten by a serpent, that's in verse 9, but anyone that's bitten by anything. Now, you see the fact that if a dog bites a person, this does not, a person will not die from a dog bite, okay? Nor will a person die ordinarily if a donkey bit him. But over here you see that the person was going to die even from a dog bite or any animal that bit him. What does that show you? It shows you that the death was not caused by the animal biting him. The death was caused by the sin, which is ordinary divine providence. The only thing is that it was accompanied with a bite from an animal. And I'm going to get to why that was so. There was a reason for that. I'm going to explain that. But what I want to show you from a careful analysis of the text is that it is not speaking, the bite is not speaking of a venomous bite. Nor in verse 9 does it say that the snake was venomous. Just as if a snake bit a person, then it would require something additional. It would require more than to just see it, but it would require gazing as well. And we're going to get into what exactly that means, okay? Now, but I want to make this clear, that a careful analysis of the text shows you that it was not the venom, it was not a venomous poison that was killing the person. The person just looked at the snake and they were cured. That's not what happened. The person was dying because of another reason, because of a sin, but it was also accompanied by a bite, and I'm going to explain exactly why that is so and what this means. Okay. Now, before I go any further, I want to mention something that I think you should all be aware of. And that is based on what I said last week. And that is that Maimonides explains that it's extremely important to study magic and the all the superstitious customs of the ancient peoples and even the modern people in order to understand the Torah better. Now, there is what is magic essentially is has a rhyme and a reason to it, okay? In other words, everything in this world can always be understood logically, even when man is crazy. If you go to a person that's in an insane asylum, he may be crazy, but a good psychologist will understand why he is doing exactly what he does, because there's a logic to it. It's not the logical thing to do, but there is some kind of a logic, because everything in God's world works logically. And the unconscious part of the human mind, which is made up of the instincts, when that goes wild and takes over his intelligence, it takes it over in a special way. That's why you have different forms of mental disorder. But it's always subject to logical analysis, because everything in God's world works according to logic. Now, that's why magic, which is an expression of the primitive mind, also has some kind of a rhyme and a reason. They don't just do anything, but there's a system of magic that they use, and it works according to certain principles. And those people who study this area can explain what these principles are and show you precisely why the primitive people do what they do. Now, the most important category of magic is called sympathetic magic. Okay. Sympathetic magic means that a person does something which he mimics a certain aspect of reality in the hope to bring it about. All right? Like, for instance, if a woman was having difficulty in labor, the medicine man would come in and he would lay on the floor and writhe and try and then pass something through his clothes to imitate the idea of birth, thinking that this is going to bring about a birth. All right? I can just give you many examples of that, but some of them sound pretty wild, but it's always that principle. Like if a slave would run away, so what they would do is they would take a bug and tie him to a pole, and then he'd keep on going around and around until he came to the center, and then they would think the slave is going to get caught. Or, for instance, when warriors were out in battle, so wives were not permitted to sleep, thinking that if they fall asleep, that the husband is not going to be able to see well, and somebody's going to kill him. This is sympathetic. Sympathetic magic it takes on various forms, but there's always the same idea behind it, and that is that that you imitate something in nature in the hope of bringing that about. You're thinking about it, and you're doing something is going to effectuate a change out there. It's based on what the psychoanalysts say. It's based on the omnipotence of thought, where a person thinks that if I really think this way, that it's really going to happen. And there are other forms of sympathetic magic. For instance, if a person has, as you know, the voodoo doll, a person has an enemy, so they take the doll and they stick pins in it, or they behead it, or whatever they do. And the thought is that by doing that, the enemy is going to die. Now, this principle, these ideas of sympathetic magic, are what was very prevalent in the time of the Torah, and still exists in certain parts of the world today. And even modern man has a little touch of it. Does it sometimes in certain ways. Although certainly not as, developed. But one of the things, like for instance with a snake, if a person wanted to avoid snake bite, so what they would do is they would take a snake and they would kill it, take the ashes and make it into a fine powder, and then they'd smear it on their bodies. Okay? So the destruction of the snake would guarantee them the fact that they had a destroyed snake on them would prevent other snakes from biting them. You see? That's the way sympathetic magic works. Now, what I want to say, what I want to tell you is this, that what Moses told the people to do is exactly the opposite of the principles of sympathetic magic. No sorcerer would advise what Moses advised. It's the exact opposite. Because if a snake, if a serpent actually endangers you, you should not look at the serpent. That's the exact thing you should not do. What you must have is an antidote. You must do the exact opposite. And here Moses told the people to do something, and it's very important, to do something which goes against all everything that the entire world at that time believed in. The opposite of sympathetic magic. Okay? The exact opposite. Now, this principle is extremely important. What does it teach? What Moses was teaching the people is exactly what the rabbis taught. And the rabbis explain. It is not the serpent that makes the person live, nor is it the serpent that makes the person die. It is only God. Okay? And that's why he had them do something which was the exact opposite of what anyone would prescribe who would believe in magic. Okay? In order to remove this idea from their minds. This is not only found in this place in the Bible. It's in other places. Let me just give you one example. Take at Numbers, Numbers 7. All right, and he said in it. Okay, 10 and 11. God said, "Remove your congregation, and I will destroy them at this moment." And they fell to pieces. And Moses told them, he said, "Take and put fire on it, the incense, it, and quickly go to the congregation and bring forgiveness to them. The anger has gone forth before God, and it has begun." Okay, and that's exactly what God did. He took the incense, which is the incense. He brought forgiveness, and then verse 13, he said, "And the live and the lift and the plagues." Okay. Now, why did he use incense? And it's very well, because if you look in 17, responsible for the death of Korah and his group, 50 people that they took the incense, brought their instantaneous death. And the so it happened. So incense became an inch of death. What is an Aaron we're trying to show? It was if the incense doesn't causes the death, and turning the same incense which specifically used life and to prevent death for the people, that idea that is respect for the result and to remove any kind of to people. This concept is in several places in the Torah. Exact same concept and over here, here in the chapter that we're doing. Okay, the snake is the opposite of what's done according to the sympathetic magic. And now I'm going to see what we're supposed to do, how it was effective. Okay. Now, I'm going to explain how it works, but before I do, I must mention something else. And that is, you'll notice in the Torah that you find two kinds of bad situations for the people. One kind of bad situation for the people, Moses prays for the people, and he saves them. Okay? That's like the case of the golden calf. Alright? Then you find cases where Moses does not pray for them, they simply die. All right. The best case that I can give you is again in Numbers, where it says, for instance, Numbers 4. All right, where in the chapter 11, and where it mentions that those who were among them, the ones that came up from Egypt, suddenly were filled with tremendous desire, and then all of Israel started to cry, and they started to ask for flesh, okay, for meat. And we mentioned, as a matter of fact, I think we did it a few weeks ago. Now, over here, Moses doesn't pray for the people, if you notice. What happens is a terrible disaster. They get the meat, and they die eating the meat, as you know. However, if you take a look right before, you'll see, before, in 11:2, Moses prayed for the people, okay, and he stopped the fire. Now, the question is, when does Moses pray for the people, and when does he not pray for the people? Okay? Now, the answer, I believe, is follows a definite principle. And that is that there are two kinds of difficulties, and it's important, this is an important thing, because it's important, everything, all the stories of the Torah are important to teach us lessons in our own lives. Okay? There are two kinds of situations that a person faces. Most people's problems revolve around their daily life, okay? They are unhappy in their daily life. They are unable to expend their energies in a productive manner. And that's a common everyday problem. But then there are crises that people have in their lives. Suddenly something comes into the picture and everything is in upheaval. And we find that we're faced with difficulties. Our emotions are all upset, and we don't know how to function. That's a different kind of a problem. Now, my opinion, if you check through the case scenario, you'll find that if the problem is an inherent one, in other words, the people are simply unable to live a proper life, then Moses can't pray for them because there's nothing to pray about. In other words, the people that were filled with desire, they were unable to use their energies in Torah. They should have really not been filled for desire or for meat. That energy that was looking for satisfaction should have been used in Torah study and learning. And they were unable to sublimate, to use that energy for a higher source of satisfaction. So what happened? It became rooted in the lower sources, in the instinctual. And then they became unhappy, dissatisfied, started to complain, etc., etc. Over there, Moses can't pray because that's something which people have to face themselves. Moses cannot help you if you can't, in your personal life, adjust yourself or reach a level, a functional level, that according to Torah is considered acceptable. That's your there. There's no hope. There's no prayer. However, if people find themselves in a crisis, a situation where something happens, And they're thrown off balance, so to speak, and then they can't grapple with the situation. Now, if they don't handle it properly, of course, it shows an imperfection, because a person that's really perfected will never handle any situation improperly, and whenever they're confronted with a difficult situation, they'll know exactly what to do. I'm saying it's hypothetical. A person that would be totally perfected. People can't be totally perfected, but the more perfected we are, the more we're able to handle a crisis, which would throw the ordinary person off balance. If you're on a higher level, you'll be able to handle it. Okay. Now, when a person fails in a crisis, there's help. Now, the case of the golden calf was a crisis. Why? Because the people became very attached to Moses. And what happened was they thought he was gone, and suddenly they got filled with primitive fright. And they weren't able to handle a situation. They turned towards a physical representation of God to give them the security. And then Moses came down, and Moses told them what a horrible sin they committed. Okay, regression. They regressed back to their early primitive state. But it was a crisis situation that brought it on. They thought that their leader was gone. They got scared, frightened. Okay, there Moses can pray to God. You say, look, this was a crisis. We have to I have to build up the nation to a higher level. I'm assuming the responsibility, he tells God, and I'm going to build this nation up to a higher responsibility. So if this crisis ever happens again, they're not going to backslide. Okay? And God accepted Moses' prayer. But if it's a situation simply that a person doesn't know, can't live on a day-to-day basis properly, there's nothing to pray about. It's just you're not working on your imperfections. Okay, if you're not working on imperfections, you're not going to get anywhere, and no one can pray for you, and God can't help you. You have free will, and whatever you decided, that's exactly what's going to happen to you. Okay, so now let's take a look at the case at hand, the case that we're dealing with. All right. What kind of a case was that? Was that a case of a crisis, or was that a case of a simply they couldn't handle on a day-to-day basis their own emotions? So if you take a look at the Torah really gives you that answer right away, immediately. And I want you to take a look at that verse. Let me just give me a second here. Lost my place. Okay, yeah, it's 21:4, right? 21:4 says, and they traveled from Horar through by way of Yamsuf to go around the land of the of Edom, and it says right after that in verse 4, it says, and the soul of the people became shortened, like short, when it became like short-winded on the road. And we explain what that means. What that meant was, the troubles and the difficulties of the road suddenly reached a certain proportion where it just got to them. Okay? Now, this is an unusual situation. The sin was caused, and as we explained it last time, it was caused by a certain situation. Not an everyday, ordinary kind of situation. These are people traveling under very, very difficult circumstances, as we explained. So this is not something which is an intrinsic fault of the person, that the person is just sinning. There are extenuating circumstances. There's something that took place over there that was the basis for the sin. Okay? That's why Moses prayed. Moses prayed because he prayed to God, look, the people are have sinned, and again, they reverted to a, it's not the golden calf, but it's a mild form of idolatry, ascribing motivation to God, something which is not the human motivation, the human type motivation. This is not something which is proper. Equating God with Moses in the same phrase, in the same breath, so to speak, this is something which is not proper, but it happened under certain circumstances, dire circumstances. So therefore, Moses could pray for them just like at the golden calf. Okay, now it's interesting. God answered Moses in an interesting way. When God answered Moses, he didn't say, like he said by the golden calf, that they're forgiven. He told him to do something, and that was to take the serpent and to place it on a pole. Okay? So apparently God's answer was that this sin is partially, there are two aspects. Partially it's due to the fact that they're on the road and they're troubled and they're unhappy and it's very difficult living under such circumstances. So God has said to Moses, yes, that's part of the reason why they sin. But another part is due to their intrinsic imperfection. And the intrinsic imperfection is that they are speaking against, there were two sins over here. One is they were speaking against Moses, and that was the sin of the evil tongue, which is ascribing to Moses the false motivation. And secondly, there was an anthropomorphic sin, that they're anthropomorphizing God. Okay? So there were two sins over here. Now God said that this is not simply a case like the golden calf where there was a situation that was the essence of their crisis. Over here, it's both. It's a combination, sort of. So God said, I will forgive them, but they must really, there's only, they must make a change in themselves in order for them to be really forgiven. Because it's not just a, it's not just an event that took place because of a crisis. It's part of their personality is really distorted, and that's why they're sinning in this case. Now, what was the remedy? The remedy was the snake that Moses made out of copper. And again, it's the exact opposite of magic, the opposite of sympathetic magic, and the purpose of the snake was to bring to their mind the idea of the first snake that did the same exact sin, which was to speak anthropomorphically about God and to ascribe to God a human base emotion and to say that God doesn't like competition. That's why he doesn't want Eve and Adam to eat from the tree, because then he's going to have other competitors. This was the very sin of the primal snake. So God said, you take that snake and place it on a pole so that when they sin, they should look at that, realize what their sin is, understand it and think into it. Then if they could remove that from themselves and they can truly repent, then I will forgive them. Okay? Now this is not symbolic. Symbolic is sympathetic magic. That's symbolic. In other words, if I want my enemy to be destroyed, I take a likeness of my enemy and I burn him in effigy. See, that is symbolic. This is the opposite of symbolic. It does not work according to the principles of sympathetic magic. It's just the opposite. And on the contrary, the looking at the snake was not, as the Talmud says, the looking at the snake was not there to effectuate a cure. It was there to get the person to realize and to think into his sin. Now, the nature of man is, you see, and this is the opposite of sympathetic magic. In sympathetic magic, when the person is, if a person's bitten by a snake, so what will the person say? That if he doesn't want to get bitten in the future, he will take something which is the opposite. In other words, destroy the snake and kill the snake and then take that as an antidote or some other kind of antidote. But over here, God says no. On the contrary, you cannot run away to the opposite, run away from this. You have to face it. If that sin is really a part of your nature, you can't run away from it now. You must look at the snake, go into it, think into it, don't deny it. Recognize that this is a part of your nature, this has become part of your nature, and this is a serious evil, and this is precisely the evil of the primal snake, and this is something which you're not going to run away from. You must look into this seriously. Now, what the Torah says in the way we analyzed verse 8 and verse 9 is that there were different categories of people. There were some people that didn't have this sin fully in a fully developed form. Others had it in a more developed form. Now, the ones that had it in a less developed form, they were also bitten, but they weren't bitten by snakes. They were bitten by other animals. Now, the reason why they would die is because of their sin, as I explained before. But the biting was a sign to them that they were involved in the sin of the snake, which is the sin of anthropomorphizing God, but not to the same degree as the ones that were bit by snakes. So that's why the cure was dependent upon the degree of the sin. And this sin which is idolatrous, but again, it's an idolatrous kind of a sin, and I explain idolatry exists on different levels. There were two distinct levels over here that were singled out by the Torah. One level was the one that was just bitten. Then they just had to see the snake, and they were forgiven. Because we know that a person, the Talmud explains, a person can repent in a split second. It does not, repentance could be very, very quick. Repentance there's no time value attached to repentance, a time requirement, okay? It It depends on the person, depends on the sin. So over here you had two levels. One level was where the person was simply bitten by anything besides a snake. That was an indication that the person had the sin, but it wasn't really firmly rooted as a part of their nature. Then, when they simply looked at the snake, means they just thought into it and they repented, that was enough. But the second level was where the person was deeply rooted in sin. Where the person was deeply rooted in sin, then they had to gaze at the snake, which meant the gazing, the commandment to gaze, meant that they must look deeply into their own nature and that they must uproot this and make a serious change in their nature. Now, it's interesting. The Torah always has a differentiation between two levels of sin. It differentiates between a person who has sinned, and it differentiates and a person who is essentially sinful. And in Hebrew, there are two different words for it. And if you look through the Torah and the prophets, you'll find that these two words have the two different significations. In other words, when the Torah says, one word is chotem. When the Torah says chotem, it means people who have sinned. When the Torah says chata'im, that means people whose essence is sin. For instance, in Sodom and Gomorrah, over there, it mentions, it says the people of Sodom, it says in Genesis, were evil, and it uses that second word, and essentially sinful. Whereas in other cases it says people did sins, it says they were sinners. Alright? The Torah recognizes that there are two different levels of human beings. A person can sin, doesn't mean they're essentially sinful. They fell through, they failed, there was some kind of miscalculation due to certain circumstances perhaps. Those people are only called sinners, but not as people who are essentially sinful. Now, over here, in this case, what the Torah did was it differentiated between two levels of people that were involved in the same sin. Some of them were sinners. And we mentioned before that in the beginning of the chapter, it explains that the people were exhausted, weary from the road and all the difficulties that are entailed in traveling. And their nerves were frazzled, and they weren't at peace with themselves. And this was the cause of the sin. Okay, that was the circumstance. And I mentioned, however, God said that that's part of it, but it's also due to an internal imperfection which they have to face up to, and if they don't face up to that, then nothing's going to help them, and Moses' prayers wouldn't help them. They must face up to that right now, and it's not due to the road alone. Over here, we see that same idea is being followed through. In other words, the people that were sinners essentially mainly because of the circumstance, in other words, the reason why they were sinners was because of the fact that they were road weary and their nerves were strained, those individuals, you see, only had to look at the serpent because the sin was not essentially a part of their nature. But there was another group that the road weariness was not the primary cause. Yeah, they were tired, but the primary cause was a gross imperfection in their own nature. And those were the ones that were bitten by snakes and had to gaze at the snake, which showed them that they must gaze into themselves, into the sin of the primal snake, and to remove from their mental framework the false notions that they have about God, and if they don't do that, then they will die. So this was the method that was employed in order to teach the people of Israel in that situation what repentance is, what sin is, the difference between a person that is brought to sin through crisis, the difference between a person that's brought to sin because of their internal intrinsic nature, and how God deals with each person and analyzes each person and deals with them on their own level and according to their own deeds and the depth and the degree of their sin. That's what this that's what this event taught them. Now, it's interesting. In Ezekiel, it states that what happened was that the people started to, after the, when the evil king started among the kings of Judah, so the people started to worship this serpent of Moses. And then they started an incense before. It's one of the forms of worship. And it states that Hezekiah took the serpent and he crushed it, he ground it down to powder, and he simply destroyed it. But it's interesting, if you take a look at the verse, let me just get that verse for you. It's very interesting. When you take a look at the verse in Kings, it's Kings 2:18, I think. Here it is. It's Kings 2:18:4. All right. It says, well, 2:18:3 says that he did that which was just in the eyes of God, just like his father David. And it says he removed the altars and he broke the platforms that were used for idolatry. All right. Then it says, and he cut the the nachash nachashis. Oh, by the way, I forgot that one point. What's the importance of the homonym? The importance of the homonym is to show that it's not the object, but the word. That's why he used nachash nachashis, to show the people it's not the physical thing, it's the word, because the word is an idea, and the idea is of the primal snake. So he used a homonymous kind of figure in order to attract them to the fact that the word is nachash, and it's not this physical thing, but it's the word that is important, because that word represents the snake, the primal snake. Okay, now let's take a look over here again at Kings 2:18. Now it says that he cut the snake, basically he cut it up into pieces, ground or whatever, and he says because until that time, meaning from the time of the bad kings, the children of Israel were offering incense to it. Now take a look at the end of that verse. It says, and he called it, what did he call it? In Hebrew it says, Nechushtan. Now what does it mean he called it Nechushtan? So Rashi, all the commentaries say, it is a degrading language. I'm reading Rashi. It's a degrading language. In other words, what purpose is there, Rashi says, so to speak, what purpose is there in this? All it is a snake of copper. You see, now, let me explain what Rashi is saying. And this is the other commentaries as well. This is the plain commentary in the verse. He called it, why does it have to say he called it a copper? It means, the chushta means a piece of copper. What he told the people was the Torah's refutation against all idolatry. You see, when they worship something that's made out of stone, it's not the stone, it's not a lump of stone that they worship, it's because the stone is shaped in a certain configuration, and that configuration gives them the feeling that there's some kind of a soul to this thing, and that there's some kind of power to it. So, what Hezekiah said was, he called it copper. He said, the fact that it has a shape doesn't mean anything, it's just a lump of copper. Are you ready to worship a lump of copper? A lump of copper, everybody knows, has no power, it's nothing. But when you make it into a shape, then it becomes something which attracts the imagination, and people start projecting onto this thing. Ooh, look at the shape. It was made by Moses. This is something which really has power. So Hezekiah said the standard refutation of the Torah. Torah always is the same refutation. It says the gods of stone and gods of wood that can't hear, can't see. In other words, the shape you mold the thing into is meaningless. That's just an accidental feature. It's basically a piece of wood and a piece of stone, and he simply called it a lump of copper. So to remove any kind of mystical attraction, and to show the people that this mystical attraction is total nonsense. That's what how Hezekiah refuted the idol worshippers, and he destroyed it. Of course, the Talmud says, how is it possible that Hezekiah, the ones that preceded Hezekiah that were virtuous, why didn't they remove it? So the Talmud says that sometimes in the course of history, There are things that are left, that God leaves a some place for an individual to another individual to come along and accomplish something. And this was one of Hezekiah's great accomplishments. Now, the reason why it was one of his great accomplishments is because the ones that came before him didn't destroy it because they wanted to keep the serpent of Moses in order to remind people of the evil that was done by the people, the evil tongue against Moses, and that which was an evil ideas about God. But what, and that's why they didn't destroy it, because they thought it's a good thing for the people to remember that sin and never to fall prey to that sin again. But Hezekiah said no, that he had to weigh that benefit against the danger of becoming an idolatrous object. And when he weighed the two, he made the decision, and this was his great achievement on his part, and he had the courage to make the decision to actually destroy it. Now, that took a lot of courage, because after all, remember, this is something which was for Moses. And people say, well, maybe we should keep this because, you know, it'll influence people for the good. But he had to make the decision, weigh one thing against the other, and he saw that the emotions of the people, the danger of idolatry is too great, and therefore he simply said the benefit, we're going to have to forfeit the benefit in order to make sure that we don't have the harm, which is the people falling prey to primitive idolatry. And that was a decision that was made on his part, and the Torah praises him for it, and he was, the ones before him really didn't have that good judgment, and that's why they let it go, and he is praised for that, and that's why the Talmud says that sometimes you can't always say, well, if my teacher allowed it, then maybe it's right. That's not necessarily true, because there are times when it's up to you. You have to make the decision, and if a person is knowledgeable, they have to have the courage to make the decision, even though his predecessors didn't make that decision. But he saw this thing clearly, and it was clear to him that the danger outweighs the benefit, and therefore he had to make that decision to destroy that object. So that of course is an important principle of Torah, that we don't just say, well, my predecessors said it was okay, so who am I to come along and say that it's not okay? Because God gave every individual a creative mind, and sometimes the predecessor, you know, he's only a human being, it was an oversight.
Yeah, well, we got less than a minute.
Okay. So if you see something clearly and you see that that's the truth, you have to move with that. Okay, and that's one of the great achievements of Hezekiah, that he had the courage of his knowledge and his conviction, and even though his predecessors, who were great people, didn't object, he moved in and destroyed the potential idolatry. Okay, we'll stop here.